Bonjour, je m'appelle Frédéric Gagnon et je suis titulaire de la chaire Raoul Dandurand en études stratégiques et diplomatiques de l'UQAM. Vous écoutez le balado de la chaire, le balado qui vous permet d'entendre nos conférences si vous les avez ratées. Le 14 novembre, Christopher Sands, directeur du Center for Canadian Studies à l'Université Johns Hopkins, a présenté une midi-conférence sur l'état des lieux des relations canado-américaines à un an des élections américaines de 2020. Il nous a parlé du débat sur l'AEUMC à Washington et de l'impact que le duel présidentiel de 2020 pourrait avoir sur nous au Canada et au Québec. Je vous souhaite une bonne écoute. Bonjour tout le monde, merci d'être ici. Je vous souhaite la bienvenue à cette midi-conférence qui porte sur l'état des lieux des relations canado-américaines. Donc un thème assez général, mais qui nous permettra d'aborder plusieurs sujets liés à cette relation canado-américaine. Quelques semaines après les élections fédérales canadiennes de 2019, vous connaissez les résultats de cette élection, sinon il faut quand même reprendre le retard, lire un petit peu l'actualité. Il y a eu des élections canadiennes, comme vous le savez, et il y aura aux États-Unis très bientôt, dans un an, mais c'est bientôt parce qu'on a l'impression qu'on est déjà en campagne électorale, des élections présidentielles. Monsieur Trump affrontera un ou une démocrate. Bon, à moins que ça se passe autrement à la Chambre des représentants et au Sénat au cours des prochaines semaines, on verra ce que ça donne. Mais on voulait faire un petit peu, brosser un portrait de l'état des lieux de cette relation canado-américaine à ce moment très crucial de notre histoire. Donc, je m'appelle Frédéric Gagnon, je suis titulaire de la chaire Raoul Dandurand en études stratégiques et diplomatiques. Je suis aussi directeur de l'Observatoire sur les États-Unis de la chaire Raoul Dandurand. Et comme vous le savez, l'élection de Donald Trump en 2016 a causé beaucoup d'inquiétudes de ce côté-ci de la frontière quant à l'avenir des relations canado-américaines. Sur plusieurs enjeux, en fait. Hein, les Canadiens et les Québécois s'étaient habitués à une présidence différente avant celle de M. Trump, la présidence de Barack Obama. Je pense que c'est le moins qu'on puisse dire. Ce sont des présidents très différents. M. Obama avait proposé un certain nombre de projets qui faisaient rêver certains membres de nos gouvernements, et notamment du gouvernement à Québec. Je me rappelle du programme de relance de Barack Obama qui visait notamment à développer des trains à grande vitesse, notamment, tu te rappelles de ça, Ginette, entre la ville de New York et la ville de Montréal. Un président aussi qui voulait davantage miser sur les énergies vertes, les emplois verts, les énergies renouvelables plutôt que sur les combustibles fossiles, même si en même temps, le président Obama a adopté une politique énergétique beaucoup plus pragmatique en cours de route, sa politique « all of the above » qui visait entre autres aussi à développer les combustibles fossiles pour réduire la dépendance énergétique des États-Unis dans diverses régions du monde, notamment à l'égard du Moyen-Orient. Donc, Trump est élu en 2016 et je ne sais pas si vous avez regardé les sondages d'opinion au Canada sur ce que les Canadiens et les Québécois pensent du président Trump, mais évidemment, il y a eu un retournement assez évident, si bien qu'une très grande majorité, finalement, des Canadiens se disent inquiets aujourd'hui de l'effet que M. Trump peut avoir sur le Canada et en particulier sur l'économie canadienne. Et je pense qu'on a beaucoup parlé de commerce, d'économie depuis que M. Trump est au pouvoir parce qu'il fait les choses autrement. Il fait les choses autrement sur bien des enjeux et sur l'enjeu commercial à l'égard du Canada aussi. On a souvent dit que le Canada et les États-Unis entretiennent une relation spéciale, une relation extrêmement cordiale. On sait qu'il y a eu des désaccords dans le passé sur certains enjeux, des enjeux commerciaux comme le bois d'œuvre, par exemple. Mais Trump fait les choses autrement parce que vous le savez, et notre invité va en parler un petit peu aussi, on a affaire à un président qui, dès l'élection présidentielle de 2016, dit des choses auxquelles on n'est pas habitué. C'est-à-dire, on veut renégocier l'ALENA avec le Canada et le Mexique. Et si nos partenaires canadiens et mexicains ne veulent pas renégocier l'ALENA, bien, on va tout simplement déchirer cet accord-là. Donc ça, c'est assez surprenant, évidemment, d'entendre ça. Au nord de la frontière canado-américaine, on n'est pas habitué à ce type de discours parce que les prédécesseurs de M. Trump nous ont dit, même si Barack Obama avait parlé de renégocier l'ALENA durant les primaires démocrates. Hein, il y a d'autres candidats aux élections qui avaient dit que c'était peut-être le temps de renégocier cet accord. Mais d'entendre un président ou un candidat à une élection dire « on va déchirer l'accord si la négociation ne mène pas là où on veut qu'elle mène », ça, c'est assez surprenant, évidemment. Et ça peut expliquer les résultats dans les sondages dont j'ai parlé tantôt, c'est-à-dire qu'il y a une très grande majorité de Canadiens aujourd'hui qui estiment que M. Trump va avoir un effet néfaste sur l'économie canadienne. Mais donc, un président qui a fait quelques promesses en 2016, des promesses importantes pour nous au Canada et notamment sur le commerce, renégociation de l'ALENA, bien, il y en a eu une. Hein? Notre invité Christopher Sands va en parler aujourd'hui. Renégociation qui a mené à la signature d'un nouvel accord de commerce, l'AEUMC, dans le cadre d'un projet de recherche sur lequel on travaille, Christophe Cloutier et moi. D'ailleurs, il y a d'autres membres de cette équipe qui travaillent avec nous, Daphné et d'autres, sur ce projet CRSH qui nous permet d'évaluer le poids du discours de Trump sur la manière dont on parle des enjeux commerciaux aux États-Unis. Mais on le voit, ce président donc, a proposé de renégocier l'ALENA et M. Trudeau a eu l'impression que c'était sérieux, cette affaire. Et c'était sérieux parce que M. Trump l'a dit en campagne électorale et il a tenu à peu près le même discours depuis qu'il est président. Et ce que je voulais dire, c'est qu'il y a des documents, on l'a découvert dans le cadre du projet de recherche sur lequel on travaille, il y a des documents qui ont été déclassifiés, si je peux m'exprimer ainsi, des documents qui nous proviennent de l'ambassade des États-Unis à Ottawa, donc des gens qui travaillent à l'ambassade, qui ont communiqué des informations à Washington dans lesquelles l'ambassade dit que dès l'élection de M. Trump, Justin Trudeau a modifié les priorités de sa politique étrangère et s'est doté d'une politique étrangère « America first ». Et on l'a vu, c'est un président qui a obligé M. Trudeau à revoir certaines priorités de politique étrangère, à investir beaucoup de ressources dans la gestion d'un dossier, un dossier très important, le dossier canado-américain. Donc, il y a eu renégociation de l'ALENA. Mme Freeland a investi beaucoup de temps et d'efforts dans cette renégociation. Je pense qu'au Canada, si on regarde les sondages, on a tendance à estimer, une majorité des Canadiens ont tendance à estimer que la renégociation s'est quand même bien déroulée, que M. Trudeau et Mme Freeland ont quand même bien géré le dossier, surtout Mme Freeland, pourrait-on dire. Mais donc, il y a eu renégociation de l'ALENA, il y a l'AEUMC qui est sur la table. L'AEUMC n'est toujours pas en vigueur parce qu'ils font un vote dans les deux chambres du Congrès sur cet enjeu-là. Les membres de la Chambre des représentants n'ont pas nécessairement la tête à ça en ce moment, comme vous le savez. Et il y a un autre dossier dont on a beaucoup parlé au cours des derniers mois. Ce sont les fameux tarifs que Trump a décidé d'imposer à plusieurs pays à l'échelle internationale. On sait qu'il y a une guerre commerciale avec la Chine, mais il y a eu aussi des tarifs sur l'acier et l'aluminium canadien qui ont été en vigueur pendant un an, qui ont été levés il y a quelques mois. Justin Trudeau était très heureux de ça. Plusieurs Canadiens et Québécois de régions dont l'économie dépend de ces secteurs d'activité, le Saguenay-Lac-Saint-Jean notamment, bon, les gens dans ces régions étaient très contents qu'on lève les tarifs sur l'acier et l'aluminium. Mais on le voit, c'est un président qui fait les choses autrement, à l'échelle internationale, qui bouscule nos manières de nos façons habituelles, nos routines, nos façons de voir les choses, et notamment sur des dossiers peut-être que l'on tenait pour acquis. Hein? Et ce que cette présidence démontre pour le moment, c'est que peut-être qu'on devra être un peu moins passif dans notre gestion de la relation avec les États-Unis. Peut-être qu'on devra s'habituer à ne plus tenir cette relation-là pour acquise. Et donc, il faudrait investir plus d'efforts pour mieux comprendre ce pays, pour établir les liens avec les bons acteurs aussi sur le terrain qui pourront rappeler à quel point bien, la relation avec le Canada elle est bénéfique pour les deux pays, ce qu'on remet de plus en plus en question dans certaines régions des États-Unis. Donc, le but de l'activité d'aujourd'hui, c'est d'attirer un petit peu votre attention sur ces grands dossiers qui font jaser aux États-Unis, ces grands dossiers en lien avec le Canada. Et il n'y a pas meilleur invité, je vous dirais, que Christopher Sands pour en parler. Christopher Sands est un ami de longue date. C'est un des grands experts des relations canado-américaines, j'ai presque envie de dire au monde, mais aux États-Unis, ça, c'est très clair. He is a senior research professor and director of the Center for Canadian Studies at the School of Advanced International Studies, SAIS, at Johns Hopkins University. He was named a fellow and director of the CSIS Canada project in 1995, where he directed research on various issues, the impact of the 9/11 attacks on the Canada-US border and bilateral trade, for instance. From 2005 until 2012, he was an adjunct professor at American University in Washington, D.C. He joined the faculty of Johns Hopkins University as an adjunct professor in 2009 and as senior research professor in 2014. He was named, that was in 2012, the fifth G. Robert Ross Distinguished Visiting Professor in the College of Business and Economics at Western Washington University in Bellingham, a beautiful place. And Dr. Sands is also a member of the advisory boards of the McDonald Laurier Institute in Ottawa and of the Canada-United States Law Institute, a joint institute of the law schools of Case Western Reserve University and the University of Western Ontario. And last but not the least, he's also an associate member at La Chaire Raoul Dandurand, and we're really happy about that. So, vous avez l'occasion de m'entendre souvent. Ce que je voulais faire aujourd'hui, c'est surtout laisser le temps à Chris Sands d'aborder plusieurs des thèmes dont il voulait nous parler aujourd'hui. Il m'a promis, he promised to talk about the USMCA. Where are we with this debate? And where's the debate on this in Congress, first of all? Maybe we can talk about that. He also promised to talk about maybe the impeachment process that we talk about a lot these days, and also the 2020 election. That's a big project, but I'm sure you'll be able to talk about all these issues. Et on va donc entendre M. Sands pour une trentaine de minutes environ. Et ensuite, on pourra échanger avec lui, lui poser toutes les questions qu'on a envie de lui poser. Et I want to thank Chris for being here today. He has a very busy day because he's speaking at AXUS, the AXUS conference today. He's on three panels. He had a meeting before this. I don't think he had lunch, but he wanted to be here at UQAM, and I want to thank him very much for being here. Merci, Chris.
Merci. Merci Frédéric. Je commence en français, mais malheureusement, mon français se fut en panne après quelques minutes. Alors, je parle en anglais, mais je comprends le français si vous avez une question plus claire en français. Demandez-moi en français. Je peux répondre en anglais probablement ou avec l'aide de Frédéric. So I have a lot to cover. And I'm going to do something that I usually try to do, which is start with facts, not fake news, and then work from the facts to the analysis. And the reason I want to do that is there is so much to keep track of, but that is specific. And I'm going to work in reverse order to the way that Frederick suggested this. I'm going to begin with the U.S. election calendar, then I'm going to talk a little bit about USMCA, and then I'm going to talk about impeachment in order to kind of watch how all of those different timelines interact. So first on the U.S. election. Working backwards, you know the American election will be November 3rd, 2020. That we've known that for a while. And the candidates will be chosen, finally, for the two parties in August for the Republicans, August 24 and 27, very close to Labor Day and the beginning of the fall season. The Democrats are having their convention in Milwaukee, July 13 to 16, so much earlier in the summer. And that means that that summer period when everyone's at the cottage or the lake is going to be a period in which there's almost a phony war. Everyone knows the outcome. The Republicans will pick Trump. If you follow this as closely as I know Frédéric Gagnon does, the Republican Party has already changed its rules So that we used to have Mark Sanford running for the nomination and William Weld, the former governor of Massachusetts, but they changed their rules this year so that there would be no primary debates at all. And the party made sure that there would be no access to funding for any candidate other than Donald Trump. So while other candidates could run, they were going to be crushed very quickly. So that's nice. We have no surprises from the Republicans. For the Democrats, we're in a very interesting period, and you, I know, are watching this. We have several candidates that are viable and several candidates that are not. And we have a couple of candidates who are just appearing on the scene very late in the process, which is fine because we haven't begun the selection process formally. So to take those in order, we have a winnowing group of candidates of whom four are standing out as the most likely given their current poll support. And you probably know them all. There is Joe Biden, the former vice president. There is Elizabeth Warren, the Harvard law professor who is now a senator from Massachusetts. There is Bernie Sanders. Everybody loves Bernie, and he's very close to you all, Vermont, senator from Vermont for quite a long time. And then we have a sort of question mark on the fourth spot. It's probably Pete Buttigieg. I'm still practicing saying Buttigieg, but it's at least slightly better pronounced than my French. And Mayor Pete is doing well on fundraising, but so far has not really entered that top three set of candidates. The two outside candidates that we sort of heard about this week are Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, and Deval Patrick, who is making noises, the former governor of Massachusetts. Now, Deval Patrick is an interesting candidate in that he's very Obama-like, African-American, well-regarded, a lawyer, but he's always avoided getting into the race. He's not wanted to be in the race, but I think the fact that he's letting his name be floated relates directly to the fact that the two other leading Democratic candidates who are African-American are not doing well. Kamala Harris, who's the senator from California, and Cory Booker, who's the senator from New Jersey. Neither of them has really broken out, leaving three people at the top who are all over 70 years old and are all white. Now, there's a little diversity. Elizabeth Warren kind of counts as diversity, but there's not very much diversity. And that has a lot of Democrats worried. Michael Bloomberg is different. He's always been around politics. Some of you will know when he was mayor of New York, he was a Republican, but not a very ideological one. Now he's proposing to run as a Democrat. The advantage that he has is $50 billion. So he doesn't have to raise any money. He can hire the best consultants by doubling the salary of whoever is paying them now and can create an organization very, very quickly. He describes himself as a short Jewish candidate no one would vote for, and yet is thinking of getting into this race mainly because he cannot stand Donald Trump. He's already been criticized within the Democratic Party for taking votes away from Joe Biden, who in some ways is in the same space, a relatively moderate traditional Democrat, and he has more money than Joe Biden. Even with all Hunter Biden's extra money made on the side in Turkey and Ukraine and China, he still doesn't have as much money as Michael Bloomberg. So this is kind of the state of the race. It's a very uncertain field. And I can talk about some of the other candidates. So for the Democrats, the challenge is this. Some people vote for a candidate. Most people vote against a candidate. And there are a lot of people who want to vote against Donald Trump, but they need someone who they think can win. There are some people who would like a candidate who is more progressive, but they are worried that the someone like Elizabeth Warren can't win. because they can't get the middle of the country to vote for them. So the party is really wrestling with that right now. So what happens next? Just a quick schedule so you can keep track of this. Our next candidate debate is next week, Wednesday, the 20th. The Democrats scheduled that before Prime Minister Trudeau announced he was going to tell us who his cabinet was on the 20th. So that'll be news like in the morning, and then in the afternoon it'll be back to the Democrats. There's one more debate on the 19th of December, just in time for Christmas. We'll have that debate. And then we have another kind of quiet period until we begin the primaries on February 3rd. You're going to get a lot of this from Professor Gagnon because I know he tracks this very closely. But just to give you a sense of the early part, they are the Iowa caucuses on February 3. New Hampshire primary, February 11. The Nevada caucus, which has been moved up this year, is on February 22nd. And the South Carolina primary is on February 29th. Each one of those is in a different region to test how well the candidates do with different parts of the country. Obviously, the Midwest, New England, the South, and the Southwest. And that's by design. Some people like primaries, some people don't. But the advantage of primaries and caucuses is the party can test market who has support and who can get momentum coming out of all of these different regions of the country. And then March 3rd comes. You might be in spring break. You'll be starting to think of thawing weather, maybe. No, probably still have snow. But March 3rd is Super Tuesday. And on that day, at the same time, we have several states who have primaries. The big ones, though, are California, which is on that date, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Texas, big Virginia, big states with a lot of delegates to choose. My guess is that on March 4th, we'll know who the Democratic candidate is, because we will have tested them in the early rounds, and then we'll have so many states deciding on March 3rd that if they're lucky, the Democrats will have a candidate with a prohibitive lead. The primary season and caucuses continue all the way through the spring up to the convention in July, but we should have a favorite earlier, making the later contest not as exciting. But I have some friends who insist that we may not know, that the problem is all of the candidates on the Democratic side are so close that we could go to a convention with no one able to win on the first ballot. If that's the case, the Democrats changed their rules from last time because, of course, Hillary Clinton was mad about the way the selection process went. So the new rules are that the Democratic Party has superdelegates. These are people who are former office holders who get to have votes as delegates at the convention. They're not allowed this year to vote on the first ballot, but they can vote on the second ballot, and there are about 400 of them. So the thinking within the party is if no one wins on the first ballot, the superdelegates will make the decision on the second ballot to prevent the discussion of candidates from going on too long. They may choose who's the most popular, but I think they're going to choose who they think can win the most. They're going to play this as how do we win and how do we beat Trump. All right. So that's the democratic process as it goes forward. Now I want to talk a little bit about what's going on in Washington, D.C. in the congressional process, which, of course, is watching all this. We have several streams of activity. Impeachment, USMCA, and I'll add one more, which is the budget, because the budget is also part of setting the atmosphere for Congress in the run-up to the end of the year. The budget is interesting. We have been funding the government on continuing resolutions without a new budget, and we just got a decision this week to extend the current funding until the 21st of December. And so the government will not close before the 21st of December. But between now and then, the House and the Senate have to agree on a budget and pass that budget in order for the government not to shut down. That's always the most difficult thing that Congress does, because Republicans and Democrats have different priorities. It will be harder because of impeachment. Now, the impeachment process is very interesting. I will only say a couple of things about it, and I'll say this apart for some of you who are younger. I was doing a talk about NAFTA and USMCA the other day, and I was first reminded that most of my students didn't remember before NAFTA. But now, I've also realized that most students now don't remember impeachment from Clinton, because that was 92, 93, 94, 95. It was that whole period. So you might have been like in elementary school, but you wouldn't have remembered it in detail. So it has a process. It begins with what amounts to an indictment, the vote of impeachment, which starts in the House of Representatives. That indictment is then sent to the Senate, which tries it like a giant jury, with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court serving as the presiding officer for this. I don't know if like William Rehnquist or John Roberts saw multiple stripes. He made up his costume for that. It was very interesting. So that's the process. It's in the House now. Now, normally, the constitutional process is impeachment is debated in the Judiciary Committee of the House. However, Gerald Nadler, who is the Democratic chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, had been holding hearings with no great result. And so Speaker Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi, chose to give responsibility for that process to Adam Schiff, who is a California congressman who is the chairman of the House Committee on Intelligence. Intelligence is an interesting committee. It's very bipartisan, and it tends to be, it has most of its meetings in closed session because it's dealing with intelligence matters. It was thought that this committee could meet in closed session and that this would move the process forward a little more quickly. They could interview witnesses to find out what they had to say, and many of the witnesses to the latest version of impeachment are intelligence officials that can't speak publicly. So they began that process, and the Republicans and the president immediately attacked it because it was a closed process, because Democrats were not allowing Republicans to ask questions or cross-examine witnesses, and the Democrats would no sooner hear testimony than they'd begin leaking it to the media rather than sharing it in a transcript form with their Republican counterparts. This led the president and first the House to condemn the process as illegitimate. And then the Senate, led by Senator Mitch McConnell, had a vote in which all of the Republican senators, except for one, and two of the Democrats voted to condemn the impeachment process and said they would refuse to treat it as a legitimate process. This led the Democrats to make some changes and to bring their process into the open, because the Senate is where the case is tried. So even if the House hates Trump and they won't be unanimous, if it goes to the Senate and the Senate won't pick up the legislation, they have to pick it up, but they won't be inclined to give it a fair hearing. The Senate has also said that because of the very partisan nature of the process, they'll do two things. One, they're going to ask all the witnesses on the House side to come in front of the Senate, and they're going to have public televised hearings allowing the president's lawyers, but also Republican senators, to cross-examine these individuals, and that no one will be granted immunity from subsequent prosecution, including people who are intelligence officials or public servants. So I guess the way to say this is going to be hardball. It's going to be very nasty. Another thing about the impeachment process that's strange is that when impeachment is in the Senate, the Congress can do nothing else. It isn't allowed to have hearings on anything else. It's not allowed to debate legislation. Everything stops until the trial is over. That matters given the time schedule that I was just laying out. Because if you're Kamala Harris or Cory Booker or Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, you're a senator. You don't want the camera to look at your empty chair because you're in Iowa campaigning. If the goal is to get rid of Trump, you have to be there in front of the cameras and saying, I'm going to vote to get rid of Trump. So if the Senate takes a bill of impeachment and drags out the hearings into this early period going into February, it will cripple many of the Senate candidates who will either have to drop out of the presidential race or they will have to sort of jet back and forth. Poor Bernie Sanders, he's already having heart trouble because it's very tough to run for president. And they're all very old. So that's an X factor, and the Republicans are doing that deliberately to try to both shame the Democrats, but also to beat them in the election. Now, you can see everyone loves everyone. This is a happy time in Washington. And now we have USMCA. It's funny. Can I just say something about USMCA? I've had the chance to do some talks on this, and it's an agreement with four names. The U.S. calls it the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement. In Canada, it has two names, and I noticed you use the American name, but the Canadian Foreign Ministry insists that Canada should come first, so they've called it the Canada-U.S.-Mexico Agreement, or CUSMA, but the French acronym is for Accord Canada-États-Unis-Mexique, so ACEUM. I put the accent aigu over the E because it sounds nice, ACEUM, but that sounds good. And the Mexicans call it TMEC for Tratado Mexico, Estados Unidos, Canada. TMEC. Sounds like T-Rex, but TMEC. One thing you'll notice about all of those names is that the words free trade don't appear in them. This is not a trade liberalization agreement. And if you read the USITC report or the IMF report on the likely impact, none of them estimate very much change or growth in GDP. Why? I think fundamentally this was a negotiation about redistributing the benefits of economic integration in North America away from Canada and Mexico to the United States. And Canada and Mexico went into the negotiation trying to make sure they gave up as little as they could. But they were not hoping for gains. We got modernization of a couple of provisions of the agreement, but it really is a step backwards, not a step forwards. However, I think everyone on all three countries has decided that we are better off with the agreement than without it. Better to have it and hope that we can fix it later. So we are proceeding in that direction. This has been the calculation among Democrats as well. On trade, one thing that makes the current progressives like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, but also Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, different than what we've seen sort of the Democratic left in the past, is they don't care much about trade. They care about healthcare, they care about the environment. Trade is not a big issue for them. So they signaled early in this process they would be willing to vote in favor of this agreement, not enthusiastically, but they would. So for Nancy Pelosi, the agreement quickly became an important bargaining chip because she has many moderate members who are in the middle of the road, who represent states that Donald Trump did very well in, who have factory jobs or jobs in farming, who care about this agreement. And they want to see it passed, and so those moderate Democrats want to vote in favor of the agreement just in order to have something that they could say they accomplished with the majority of Democrats in the House. That this process has to, like impeachment, it has to begin in the House because a trade agreement is a money bill. It affects the spending of money in the way that it affects the tariff rate, and the tariff rate is like a tax, and so it has to start in the House. And Nancy Pelosi's been trying to figure out a formula under which she could bring this into the House and start the process of approval. There are seven elements that the president had to deliver in order to complete what they call a submission package for this agreement. The seven elements are, let's see if I can get all this right, a statement of legislative action. All of the legislation that would have to be changed. It's just a list of bills that would have to be changed to implement U.S. commitments. Second, a statement of administrative action. This is all of the regulations that would have to be changed. The statutes have to be changed by the Congress, voting in both chambers. The administrative rules, the regulations, have to be changed through a process called 90-day notice and comment that's governed by the another piece of legislation that makes a determination on how you can issue rules. So both of those lists came out on time. Then there has to be a final text of the agreement, of course, the USITC report, which is done. An environment and a labor market impact assessment. These are performed by parts of the government, say this is what we think the impact of this agreement will be. And then two things that are particularly important, an enforcement plan and draft legislation. Democrats wanted commitments in the enforcement plan to tough enforcement, particularly of Mexico granting $16 an hour minimum wage for workers to qualify. They think that the Mexicans will cheat, particularly labor unions think the Mexicans will cheat, and so they've looked for really tough commitments. Robert Lighthizer, the U.S. Trade Representative, has said something different, which is if we can put those commitments into the statute, into the legislation that has to be passed to implement, then unions and civil society groups can sue the government to demand that they enforce those provisions because they are provisions of law, as opposed to political commitments from any given administration. And so what we've seen in the last couple of weeks is a negotiation about how to get the balance of enforcement right, particularly on labor in Mexico. Right now, Nancy Pelosi cannot introduce this legislation because she doesn't have the whole package, even though Trump occasionally teases her that she has to get busy. The U.S. has not completely sent everything in. And so as a result, we're in a funny period, and Nancy Pelosi is hoping that she can get everything arranged in time. Then, let's say the administration says, you have everything, we've done with our submission. What happens then? Well, the administration will give draft legislation to the Congress, but it's only a draft. And so the Democrats can then change the draft legislation because they haven't introduced it yet. Congress gets to write legislation ultimately. So some people have focused on that as Nancy Pelosi's last chance to make changes to the final agreement. There is a provision that some of you may have seen in the papers that Canada put into the agreement that said that businesses that want to receive tariff benefits under the new USMCA must not discriminate on the basis of gender or sexual orientation. And when House Republicans found out about that, they complained to the president. The president called Robert Lighthizer, who put in a footnote that says, this provision does not apply to the United States of America. Very sneaky. But it was withdrawn as a concession by the U.S. at the last minute after Mexico had already approved the agreement. Very bad. However, Nancy Pelosi could take that footnote out. She could put it right back in and say, nope, now we're going to respect that. She could also tighten some of the provisions on the environment. She has some latitude to do it. And once she introduces it, the Senate has to agree to the exact same language. It can't be amended by either chamber. If this works like the U.S.-Korea trade agreement, which is one of the more recent agreements we've seen go through, from the day that she introduces it, we could pass the entire thing in the Congress in about 11 days. We have as many as 90 in each chamber, but we'll probably move more quickly because all the negotiations being done before that moment of submission. But with impeachment hanging over our heads and a stop when this gets into the Senate, there's a really good chance that if we don't move it in the next, I think what we have 10 days left of formal session, and then they're done for the year, if we don't move it in those days, it may never come up because there won't be time. What happens if it doesn't come up? Well, I don't think it's going to come up in 2021 or 2020. I don't think the parties will want to bring this forward in the middle of the presidential race. Nobody will see it as a benefit. Donald Trump will argue that he negotiated a better deal than NAFTA, and Nancy Pelosi is denying it to the American people. So he'll run on it in a partisan way. She'll say it was a terrible agreement. I didn't want to do it anyway. And then we'll have the election, and in early 2021, either re-elected President Trump or the new Democratic president will start the process over. If it's Trump, we'll probably see the same agreement. If it's a Democrat, I think some people feel the Democrats will want to revisit the entire negotiation and we'll be starting from zero. And I think if I'm betting a beer with Frederick or a glass of milk, then I would bet that we will still get it passed before the end of 2019. That's where I think we are. I think people are very close. But if we don't, obviously it'll be 2021, and then I promise to come back and talk about it then. So just putting that out. I wanted to say one last thing about the Canadian election and the interaction, so that you know there's something on the bilateral agenda we have to deal with other than USMCA. The first big piece is we don't have an ambassador in Ottawa, and you don't have an ambassador in Washington. You have a deputy, we have a chargé. So we don't have any ambassadors to each other. That's a big gap, because the ambassadors tend to be the people who do most of the early problem solving when we have disputes. People in Ottawa were asking me earlier the week, what will it be like for a minority government? How will the US approach a minority government? And I'm afraid we have a vision of this, and it's how Boris Johnson and Donald Trump are dealing with each other. Now, I know they both have bad hair and are kind of similar, but imagine for Justin Trudeau the problem. On the one hand, he needs to get along with Donald Trump on a number of issues, just like Boris Johnson needs to get along with Donald Trump because he wants a trade agreement after Brexit. But on the other hand, Donald Trump surprises. He doesn't want to extradite a diplomat who ran over a teenager and killed him. And now that's a huge political populist issue in Britain, but he's, you know, he says almost as good as ASAP Rocky, who's not allowed to go to trial in Sweden. Donald Trump is an America First nationalist. He won't let people go to trial. So even if Donald Trump likes you, you get surprises. And I think Justin Trudeau will have to be prepared for surprises going forward all year long, managing this relationship as carefully as he can. So the role of ambassador, to take those issues away from the president and the prime minister and just let them move below the surface, is very important. I expect that Canada will try to lie very low, just so as not to start a fight. But there are a couple of ways in which Canada will not necessarily be able to lie low. First, there's a NATO summit, December 3 through 5, in London, of all places, in the middle of their election. Canada is not spending the 2% Wales commitment level on defense, but I think is not target number one. It'll be a very crazy summit. It's coming up in a couple of weeks. Donald Trump will be there. It will be very strange. Also, we have the G7 summit, the Group of Seven, which is in the United States this year. Apparently at a property that Donald Trump doesn't own, which is good, but that date, we're now looking at June 10 to 12. So you're looking at a period after the Democratic candidate has been named and before the Democratic convention in that early summer. Very politically tricky. Donald Trump will try to use the summit as part of his campaign for sure, but then how will it go? There are maybe two or three good pieces of news, though, for Trudeau. And they also are on the international summit scene. In the immediate term, we have the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, which is going to be in Rwanda this year. It was supposed to be, in Malaysia, but it got moved over the summer. So they're going to be in Rwanda. This is not bad for a prime minister who's trying to get everyone to forget his blackface photos. He can be in Africa, he can commit to Africa. As a prime minister, he can throw some money in that direction, and I think it will be and Donald Trump doesn't get to come to Commonwealth summits, which is very nice. Then he has the Francophonie summit, which is expected to be just a couple weeks later, also in this period around June and early July, and that's going to be in Tunisia. And Tunisia just had an election. They have a very good president. We're sort of optimistic that he'll be a bit of a technocrat, but he'll be good. This is also very helpful for the Aladdin photos. Forget those. We'll be thinking about good relations with the Arab world. So that'll be good for Trudeau. And then two more summits to put on your agenda. Summits, again, are facts I know will happen. The first is the UN Climate Change Conference, which is going to be in Glasgow in Scotland. And the dates for that are November 9 to 19. So it's a fairly long summit next year, November, after the American election. So I don't know if Donald Trump will still be president because he won't have a new person inaugurated. At the moment, he says he's going to go. I don't know why. He walked away from Paris. He's not very interested in the environment. But it will be a tricky summit. I suspect the Prime Minister will spend all summer long talking not about pipelines in the West or about carbon taxes, but instead saying, I'm going to work on the global consensus to act on climate change, because it's something that doesn't happen until after the US election, and it won't provoke Donald Trump either way. It's an easy issue for him. And then at the end of November, 21st and the 22nd, is the G20 meeting, and it's going to be in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. And I think it's going to be a very interesting summit, I think it will be another opportunity for Trudeau to sort of be on the world stage. I'm interested to see whether he will challenge the Saudis in the way that Chrystia Freeland did previously on issues of human rights. It would be it's hard to imagine him getting kicked out of the country or arrested or being given the Khashoggi treatment. But at the same time, it might show him to be a stronger leader if he were able to raise those issues on the international scene. So, one more thing. October, we should have the UN General Assembly, and we'll have the election for UN Security Council, something that the Liberals very much wanted to get. I don't think Canada's going to get the seat because the Norwegians have a lot of money and they've been sending it around to everyone with bouquets of flowers and all of that. And then the Irish. The Irish are tricky. They're your other competitor. And nobody hates the Irish. I think it's the beer, maybe it's the music, but the Irish are doing very well with their campaign, and it looks like Canada will lose. And I think that's going to be really tough for the Trudeau government, because they made such an issue of this in the last election. And they'll need a strategy to explain why they didn't get the job. Anyway, all of that, that's a great year. Have fun. Any questions?
What are you thinking about the Huawei case?
So, we know on average extradition hearings in Canada take up to 2 years. The U.S. has said with regard to this case, they will take her as soon as Canada releases her. And there's been some talk with the State Department that the sooner we take her, then we will be we're bigger, so the Chinese can be mad at us, but you will be out of the picture. But I am not sure that that will improve relations with China immediately. It may take a little bit longer. A couple of things about that. In Washington, her arrest is being seen as a sign that Canada is more reliable. We know the CSIS here in Canada has already said that China has been spending money trying to win over politicians and influence Canadian politics. They've done the same in New Zealand, they've done the same in Australia, and yet Canada stayed with the U.S. on a crucial decision. Maybe not all the politicians were happy about that, but it did stay. So people are seeing that as a sign that Canada is a good ally, and it has actually earned Canada some credit with the president, which is positive, but you still have the problem. Second thing. Several observers, and I had a sort of meeting with intelligence officials about this after the Canadian election, saw the defeat of Ralph Goodale, the most senior, elderly, I guess, most veteran, experienced member of the Trudeau cabinet, who ran in Saskatchewan. He lost the election, and not just because the Liberals aren't popular in Saskatchewan, but in part because China targeted soybeans and canola oil, as well as pork and other products, which are big in Saskatchewan and are major exports to China, in their retaliation over the Huawei case. And so the Chinese have said that this is a victory for them, that they punished the minister who was responsible as Minister of Public Safety for the arrest of Meng Wanzhou. Whether that's how Canada perceives it, that's how the Chinese are claiming a victory in your election. I think that's actually tricky. It makes it difficult for the Trudeau government. Now, third factor, Hong Kong. We're all watching what's going on in Hong Kong. And personally, I think it will end badly, and I think the Chinese will probably have to send in the military. And if they do, I expect the U.S., but also most of the West, will join in sanctions or at least condemnation. The fact that Canada arrested Meng Wanzhou, was retaliated against, including some hostages the Chinese have taken, and yet has held its ground, even if it's paid a price to do so, I think is a powerful signal to people in Hong Kong, of whom there are, we think, about 300,000 dual passport holders who are Canadian, but a lot of others who will be looking and saying, if this goes badly and I have to get out, Canada is a good place to go. Because the Canadians, maybe because the Americans are on their side, the Canadians are a safe place. And Australia and New Zealand, maybe not so much lately. So I think this could have a huge effect. Now you think 300,000, maybe 350,000 people. What? That's 10% of your population. That's a big jump in 1 year, and it makes you a very important player in the resolution of that conflict, even if Xi Jinping is really focused on Trump. Last comment, when I was in Ottawa, we talked a lot about China with officials here, and what I would say is Canada, at least Ottawa, is so focused on the trade war component of the U.S. confrontation with China that they're missing the fact that it is also a strategic conflict, a great power conflict. And they're all worried about what's it going to mean for the Canadian dollar, and will the Chinese buy peace with the Americans by diverting trade away from Canada, and they'll instead buy things from the U.S. just because it make Trump happy and then hurt the Canadian economy. But the bigger piece is that, unfortunately, a war is an option. I hope a short one, but as long as that's the case, that could happen in this whole time period. It could happen at any moment when something stupid happens or when something escalates. If the U.S. and China are at war, typically Americans rally around the president even if they don't like them, and at least for the short term, that's a crazy black swan variable that could affect this entire election this year. And I'm not a wag the dog guy. I don't think U.S. presidents start wars to win elections or distract from their own personal scandals, but this conflict has been brewing for a long time, and it's one of the weird things. American Democrats and Republicans agree that we have to confront China in a way that the current Chinese ambassador in the U.S. is a graduate of my school, and one of the things he said to me shortly after this trade war started was, I am amazed at how the Americans hit their Cold War button, and all of a sudden I get nothing but hostility, and it's kind of a united front, China is the villain, and it was very sudden. And it's something that if you come to Washington, you'll see, but it's also not where Canada is, it's not where other countries are. The U.S. is very alone in that, but it's also very determined. And I think that's going to make it very difficult for this issue to resolve in a peaceful way. Sad to say.
Chris, I don't know if I can say that, but you're from Michigan.
Yes.
That's one of the states that made the difference in 2016. And I think, I don't know if I'm right, but many, many voters in Michigan and Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin were seduced by the way Trump was talking about trade and about the fact that he wanted to fight with China, make sure that China would change behaviors on trade, protect the U.S. intellectual property and things like that. We know that the tariffs also have had an impact on voters in this region. We know that Trump wanted to reindustrialize this region as well. Mm-hmm. Are voters who matter in these states still, are they still on board with what Trump is proposing on trade regarding China, the tariffs, et cetera, et cetera? And I guess my question is, will it hurt him in the next election, or do you think he will be able to win these states again next time?
Politics is, as Aristotle said, politics is more an art than a science, and we forget that because we're all political scientists now, so we're supposed to look at the data, but there's an art to it. And what Donald Trump has done very well is convince certain voters that he is fighting for them, and they're not worried about the details. It's about trust. They think, obnoxious as he is, that he is fighting on their behalf. And when I'm in Michigan, when I'm in Ohio, people aren't reading the USMCA text. All they know is that Trump says it's a good deal, And therefore, they say, you know, Trump's got my back. He is fighting for these issues. And they have trusted him through the agricultural tariffs with China. They've trusted him all the way through. They think he's on their side. That's thing number one. Now, my relatives are not big Republicans. And so when I talk to them, there's another phenomenon that worries me. And that is, and I think you have this in French because I think it's Aesop's fables, the boy who cried wolf. The problem with impeachment is that many people have stopped listening. They know the Democrats want to impeach Donald Trump. They know they keep saying, oh, it's the Mueller report, now it's Ukraine. Like, any minute now he'll be gone, except it never happens. It's just this, you know, I sometimes blame CNN. If you watch CNN in English, everything is breaking news. It is breaking news all the time. It's even breaking news that breaking news will be breaking later. It never stops. So people just, at a certain point, it's like, oh, call me when something happens. And the Democrats haven't been able to do anything to really fulfill people's hopes and expectations. And so as a result, people are just not paying attention. So if we find out in the hearings now that they're public that there is something really, really bad, it may be hard for that to get to voters in a way that they care about. And as close as we get to the election, there's also another argument which is out there, which is, let's just vote. You know, why go through this elaborate process? Why slow things down? Just we'll vote for him or we'll vote against him. And let the voters decide, because the congressional process, especially as it becomes very partisan, just doesn't look like it's the right way to go. So all of that has me worried that people in the Midwest are both trusting Trump, tuning out the critics, and are prepared to bring him back. Now, you know what the studies say. If the economy is doing well, which it still is, if we're at a point where unemployment is low, but also wages are rising, that they won't forever. It's going to taper off, but if the timing of that is right, people feel that, why should I not reelect the guy? Things are okay in my little world. And that is a very powerful factor. Trump has got better numbers than we've seen with African-American voters. He's not as good with Hispanics, but there are some Hispanic supporters. That's something that's going to change the calculus for the Democrats, particularly if they end up with an old white person, you know, as their standard bearer. So I guess if I were betting, I'd bet that Trump's coming back. Not happily, but I'm afraid that that's sort of where we are, unless the Democrats can really inspire. There's something they say about American politics, that there's usually a candidate of change, and a candidate, it's just their turn. And I think Joe Biden seems like a candidate who thinks it's his turn. He was vice president before, he wanted to run last time, Obama told him not to, and now it's his turn. But that's not it might be a reason he wants to go for president. It's not a reason for anyone else to vote for him, because it's his turn. So it's weird, because I think it puts Trump in the position of being the candidate of actual, you know, change. I mean, he's the guy who keeps disturbing things and making them successful. Can I also say, I only know a few people around Biden, and they were quite annoyed that Barack Obama had time to endorse Justin Trudeau and he still hasn't endorsed Joe Biden. I mean, it's kind of sad, but anyway.
Electoral interference.
Yeah, electoral interference. Yeah. That's what it amounts to. But I have a feeling poor Joe was crying.
If you guys are in Washington in the weeks or months to come, you know where to find Chris Sands. He's going to be at SAIS, Johns Hopkins University. Thank you so much for your presence today.
Vous avez aimé cette conférence de Christopher Sands? Vous voulez en apprendre davantage sur ses recherches? Consultez le site web de la chaire Raoul Dandurand au www.dandurand.ucam.ca. Et pour rester à l'affût des activités de la chaire, pour participer à nos conférences en personne, bien, suivez-nous! Vous pouvez le faire sur Facebook, Twitter et Instagram. Vous pouvez aussi vous abonner à notre infolettre hebdomadaire directement sur notre site Internet. Ce balado a été réalisé par Philippe-Julien Bougie et Clément Hamelin. On se retrouve très bientôt pour un autre balado de la chaire.